This is the 11th and last lecture of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness, Truth and Error in Spiritual Research. It was a cycle of lectures delivered August 11th through the 22nd, 1924, at Torquay, England. It is the last lecture cycle Steiner gave abroad before his death on March 30th, 1925. Lecture 11 is entitled, What is the Status of Understanding as Related to Spiritual Research? A vast deal more might naturally be said in direct continuation of what we have touched upon in these lectures, but today we shall endeavor to place before your minds a sort of summary, rounding off the lectures. From the entire tenor of these lectures, one question must appear foremost of all before the eyes of our soul. This is the question, quote, what is really the state of understanding for anthroposophy, for spiritual research, as this ought to be introduced into the world by anthroposophy? What is the state of insight into what is given through such anthroposophy, in view of the fact that it is not yet possible for every person in our day to participate directly in those exercises, in those disciplines which bring persons quickly to the point where they themselves may perceive in the corresponding worlds that which they hear by means of anthroposophy, and may thus test it in an absolutely adequate manner? This is indeed a question that lies close to the hearts of most of those who feel a certain impulse toward anthroposophy, a certain longing for it. But this question is really invariably viewed in a false light, and it may be viewed at first in an entirely false light, even because of the truth one utters, as I have done in these lectures. It may be said, quote, how, if you please, can all these descriptions out of the spiritual world help me if I myself cannot see into the spiritual world? Unquote. For this reason, I should like to weave the question at issue into the summary explanations to be given today. The case is by no means such that one can say it is impossible to develop an insight, an understanding for the things that are given by means of anthroposophy until the person himself is able to investigate in the spiritual world. It is necessary to distinguish, especially at the present time, is it necessary to distinguish, between research, that is, the discovery of such facts as belong to the various worlds, and an understanding of what is given as a result of these investigations. This distinction will become perfectly clear to you if you reflect that the human being, as he stands before us today, really belongs to various worlds, and that such experiences as he has come to him, always out of the various worlds. Let me read that again. And that such experiences as he has come to him always out of the various worlds. Man, as he is today, acquires in ordinary life the consciousness of the everyday existence and the ordinary science which we have taken as our point of departure. This consciousness gives him, during the waking life of day, a certain survey over a piece of the world, over everything in the world, which is manifest to us through the senses, and which can be interpreted, can be conceived, by means of the intellect that man has come to possess in the course of time through his evolution. Into a world that lies next to this, in a sense, but which is concealed behind the sense world, man reaches an entirely vague fashion with his understanding, as I have explained, in dreams. And into that world in which man lives between his death and a new birth, he is able to extend his reach with his soul life on earth only during dreamless sleep, during sleep while his soul is enveloped in utter darkness, and he is living a life of which ordinarily he has no recollections whatever. This consciousness with its threefold state, the waking state, the dream state, the state of deep sleep, this consciousness is known to the human being. But he does not live only in the worlds that are accessible to him by this means. Man is simply a being who lives in a whole series of worlds. His physical body lives in a different world from that of his etheric body. This again in a world different from that of the astral body, and all this together in a world different from that of the ego. And this consciousness, luminous waking consciousness, dream consciousness, sleep consciousness, one might say non-consciousness, but we should say only obscure consciousness, these are really possessed by the ego as it is today. And this ego as it is today possesses, when it looks inward, also three states. When it looks outward, it possesses three states: the waking life of day, dream consciousness, sleep consciousness. When it looks inward, it then possesses the bright thought consciousness, consciousness in thinking. It possesses the feeling consciousness, the life in feeling, much more clouded than we ordinarily think, much more similar to dream life. And it possesses the dull twilight consciousness of the will, very much like the consciousness of sleep. Our willing, as it comes into existence, is wholly and entirely unknown to the ordinary consciousness, really just as unknown as sleep. When a man wills, he possesses thought. This is clear and bright. He then develops feeling, somewhat darkly, concerning this thought. Then the thought, permeated with feeling, passes downward into the limbs. What occurs there is not experienced by a man with his ordinary consciousness. By that research of which I spoke to you yesterday and the day before, willing is perceived thus. While the thought wills something in the head, and the thought then passes downward through the feeling into the whole body, and the man then wills by means of his whole body, during this time there is developed in the man something like a finer, more subtle, more intimate process of combustion. If a person attains to initiate consciousness, he can experience this willing influenced by warmth. For customary consciousness, however, this remains entirely below the threshold. This is only an illustration of how that which can be raised above into consciousness remains nevertheless for the ordinary consciousness below the threshold. Sometime, for example, the following will be perceived if those things really come to be understood, which will be introduced into the world by means of the book to which I referred yesterday. It will be seen that when a person wills something, and this is viewed by the initiate consciousness, it is as if one were viewing the external process of the burning of a candle, or of any sort of light that generates heat. Just as we there have a clear picture by means of external vision, so it is possible to perceive the thought striking down into the will in such a way that we say, quote, the thought develops a feeling, and out of the feeling there descends below, movement in the case of the human being goes from above below, the generation of warmth, flame, and this flame wills. That is to say, it discloses itself gradually. We can actually place this customary consciousness schematically before ourselves as follows. Two columns, left column, above says within, clear thinking, life of feeling, will consciousness. To the right, above it says without, waking consciousness of day, dream consciousness across from life of feeling, sleep consciousness across from will consciousness. Without, the waking consciousness of day, within, clear thinking, without, dream consciousness, within, life of feeling, unclear but warm life of feeling, without, sleep consciousness, within, will consciousness. But now, although in order to investigate the spiritual world, that is, in order to seek out the facts that can be revealed from the spiritual world, a person is under the necessity of bearing his consciousness wherever the world is into which he wishes to penetrate with knowledge, yet if the results of his research are honestly reported to other persons, then what is thus imparted by way of ideas through words passes over into the consciousness of these other persons. And now you may perhaps understand that the matter has two aspects. The first thing that occurs is that someone investigates in the world, for example, of the human organs, as I explained yesterday. He investigates there the facts with which he is concerned, by means of those powers that enter into a man in the course of his life. The corresponding facts are then discovered. These facts lie there before his soul for its knowledge. He possesses them. People are then in the presence of these facts in the external world. These facts are then reported through those persons. They are laid before the world. When men lay them before the world, they can then be grasped by the ordinary consciousness, if only we bring to bear upon them the necessary open-mindedness. For this reason, it has always been the practice in human evolution that a few men have occupied themselves with the investigation of the facts that have to do with the spiritual world, and that these men, after having investigated them, have imparted them to others. In our day, the only thing opposed to this receiving of such forms of knowledge is the fact that men have gradually grown up in a social environment and an educational development which brings them to such fixed feeling habits that they cannot believe in anything except the external world of facts, the world of the senses, and what the understanding can impart out of the world of the senses. This habit works so strongly that it almost always inclines a person to say, quote, "There is the university. Persons are graduated from the university. Now they teach in the university. They also investigate certain facts." Or, if others investigate certain facts of the sense world, these persons then endorse this. They verify it. End quote. People believe in it. People do not investigate for themselves. They believe in it. And indeed, it is precisely in relation to contemporary science that men are endlessly credulous. They believe things that to a person possessed of insight are not only problematical, but certainly quite untrue. This is merely the outcome of an education that is one century old. This education, I may say, men did not have in previous centuries. Since something still came to all men at that time from seeing into the spiritual world, from entering vitally in feeling and in will into the spiritual world, they were more inclined to believe also those who investigated spiritual facts. Men are simply not accustomed to this in our day, and they have grown accustomed to a way of looking at things which has quite naturalized itself, more theoretically on the continent and more practically in England and America. On the continent there are elaborate theories, and in England and America a feeling as to this that people cannot by any means easily overcome within themselves. That is, men have accustomed themselves to what has come about in the course of centuries, to accept natural science as this is related to the external senses, for example, astronomy, botany, zoology, medicine, according as these things are prepared for them in recognized schools and at recognized places. Men have grown accustomed to this in the course of centuries, and today they are terribly fixed in this attitude. If a chemist investigates something in his laboratory, and people have not the least inkling as to how he does this, but it becomes known, they say, quote, "This is true. This is knowledge," unquote. They say, quote, "This is no belief. This is knowledge," unquote. It really is pure belief. But people say, quote, "This is knowledge," unquote. Now, by all the ways that men employ for the investigation of the sense world, in order to discover in a rational way the laws of the sense world, by all these ways, nothing is discovered in regard to the spiritual world. But there are really only a very few persons who can do entirely without the spiritual world. Even these few talk themselves into this, or are not really honest in it. Let me read that again. Even these few talk themselves into this, are not really honest in it. Beyond all other things, men feel a need to know something also about the spiritual world. They do not any longer listen today to those who can tell them something about the spiritual world in a contemporary fashion, but they listen to what has been handed down historically, to what exists in books, to what exists in the holy writings of the East, in the Bible. They listen to this because they cannot do otherwise than possess in some way or other a relationship to the spiritual world. In spite of the fact that everything existing in the Bible or in the holy writings of the East was discovered through research by individual initiates, they say, quote, "This indeed is another form of perception. This is not like the knowledge of the external sense world. This is not like the knowledge of science, but rests upon a belief. Here men must believe," unquote. People then make the rigid distinction, quote, "Science is one thing, faith is another," unquote. They relate science to the sense world and faith to the spiritual world. In regard to this, there are on the continent, especially among the theologians of the evangelical churches, not among the theologians of the Catholic Church, who have preserved only the traditions of earlier times, and who do not discriminate in the same manner as evangelical theologians or as the external scientists, there now exist on the continent complete theories to the effect that knowledge reaches to a certain point and then begins faith. This, they think, must be so. Here in England, there are fewer theories, because theories are not liked so well. Here, however, one finds this conduct of life wherein one pays heed rigidly on the one side to science and takes seriously whatever is derived from science, and on the other side lives rightly, piously, I will not say pietistically, in faith, and keeps these two things strictly apart from one another. This is the habit not only of laymen, it is the habit also of scholars, and has been for a long time. Newton established on the one hand the theory of gravitation, that is, a spatial world conception which by its very nature excludes any conception of the spiritual. If the world were such as Newton considered it, it could not contain any spirit. Men simply have not the courage to admit this. A divine and spiritual ruling and weaving can no more be conceived in the Newtonian world than a human being could ever come out of a spinning wheel, or a human being could be conceived within a spinning wheel. Men simply lack the inner fortitude, the inner courage to admit this. But not only are those persons who receive something in this way habituated to yield themselves on the one hand to a spatial world conception and a temporal world conception which excludes the spiritual, but even those who are themselves investigators do this. Newton himself is a fine example. He established on the one hand a world conception that excludes everything spiritual, and on the other hand, isolating his soul completely from this, he interpreted the apocalypse. The bridges have been destroyed between what is understanding or knowledge of the external sense world and what is understanding or knowledge of the spiritual world. Then, where theories are loved, the effort is made to provide this distinction rigidly. Where theories are not loved, the effort is made to assimilate it rightly in the habits of feeling and thinking, so that men by no means escape from it. On the other hand, human reason, the understanding, the force of ideas, capacity for ideas, has advanced so far in our day, if only we bethink ourselves of this, if only we take it in hand, that reason can completely grasp what comes out of initiation science, though it cannot investigate this. What then is needful? It is needful to develop this view. What is to be investigated in the spiritual world must first be investigated by such persons as are able to bring to their assistance in the present life forces out of previous incarnations, which fit them to develop what is necessary for research. What has thus been investigated will then further be taken up by a number of persons, by more and more persons, will be understood in ideas as it can be understood. If what has been spiritually investigated is taken up through a sound understanding, the basis is thereby created for the other persons to pass from understanding to really seeing into the spiritual world. For, as I have said so many times, the most wholesome way for entering really into the spiritual world is by occupying oneself at first with the reading or the taking in of what has been communicated from the spiritual world. When a person takes these thoughts in, they are inwardly vitalized, and he thereby enters not only into understanding, but also into perception, so far as his karma admits. And just at this point, one must find one's way into a conception of karma. The present-day man does not think about karma. He says that just as a person investigates sulfur in a laboratory, so also must he investigate by laboratory methods how a person produces so-called abnormal phenomena. He thinks that experiments must be made with persons who bring forth out of themselves abnormal knowledge, just as we experiment with sulfur. But you see, sulfur has no karma. Only that sulfur which is mentioned in connection with men has a karma. Ordinary mineral sulfur has no karma. Only men have a karma. And it can never be assumed that a man has it in his karma to permit himself to be experimented with in a laboratory, as we must assume if the investigations are to be fruitful. Therefore, spiritual science had first to exist. It was necessary first to investigate the conditions under which it comes about through karma that something may be learned through a man in regard to the spiritual world. I have stated this clearly in the closing part of the later editions of my Theosophy. But the contemporary world is not fitted, because of habit, not because of incapacity, but because of habit, to take in these things. Yet this is infinitely important. It is most of all important to understand clearly that it is not necessary for you to have entered directly upon the ways of research in the spiritual world. But if you only apply here on the physical plane a method not unsound, such as would be experimentation with karma, not absolutely required by karma, or with mediums whose practices you do not understand, if you simply surrender yourself to that consciousness which is at first the right consciousness for this world, and which I have described as the everyday consciousness, if you rightly surrender yourself to this everyday consciousness, you then arrive at a complete understanding of what is said out of initiation science. If anyone believes that it is not possible to possess such an understanding until one has personally entered into these things, he is giving himself up to an absolute error. This again is one of the false ways to which men betake themselves today, that of saying, quote, "What is the spiritual world to me, as long as I myself cannot see into it?" Unquote. Here lies one of the greatest, one of the most dangerous, one of the most manifest errors. This error must be vividly realized by such a movement as that which is embodied in the Anthroposophical Society. That man, with his existence here in the physical world, belongs to various worlds. This can be taken in by an unprejudiced consciousness, through observing simply that those facts which a man experiences, just as these are set forth before collective human experience, have such an appearance that wherever the weightiest matters in life are concerned, they meet with the incapacity of ordinary consciousness to understand them. They meet this by reason of the fact that they seem to be completely separated from one another, whereas in certain instances they belong intimately to one another. I should like, therefore, in this summary consideration, to refer first to the entrance of man into this physical world, and his departure from it. I should like to refer to birth and death. Birth and death, these two most decisive events in the human earthly life, seem to ordinary consciousness separated one from the other. Everything that precedes birth, that is connected with it, with the fact that man is entering into earthly existence, is placed at the beginning of the earthly life. They appear to be separated from one another. For one who investigates in the realm of the spiritual life, they draw ever closer and closer together. For when one considers that way which I have described as the entrance of a man into the moon mysteries, when one conjures the night into the day, as I described this yesterday, one perceives how in all the occurrences of the process of being born, the physical and the ether bodies become more and more germinating and sprouting, how they proceed from the tiny ovum, how they develop gradually into the human form, how even during the earthly life, one might say, they continue to show an ascending life, and only in the middle of the earthly life, about the 35th year, begin gradually to fail, to manifest a descending life. Indeed, this is perceived even externally. But one who betakes himself to that moon way of which I spoke yesterday now sees also how at the same time when a sprouting and germinating life of the ovum begins for the physical and etheric and forms itself still further, another life, which we embrace in the realm of anthroposophy under the terms astral body and ego, really dies, succumbs to death. If a person enters thus into the mystic life which I described yesterday concretely, he does not merely perceive a process wherein the physical and the etheric are being born, but he sees a dying of the astral and of the ego. We see death weaving itself into life, the dying wedding itself to the germinating. Furthermore, if we observe the human being with this initiate consciousness, we see at the time when the body fails, from the 35th year on, the beginning of a vitalizing in the astral and the ego. These are only disturbed by what is dying away round about them in the physical and the ether nature, yet a real vitalizing occurs. We thus learn, through this way of spiritual research, to know death already in life, life in death. In this way we prepare ourselves to follow what we see dying during the process of being born further into the pre-earthly existence, where it manifests itself in its full significance, in its greatness. Let me read that sentence again. In this way we prepare ourselves to follow what we see dying during the process of being born further into the pre-earthly existence, where it manifests itself in its full significance, in its greatness. And since during the dying off of the earthly life we perceive the astral and the ego nature gradually becoming fresher, only held in captivity through the etheric and the physical, we are thus prepared again to follow what passes through the portal of death out of the human physical and etheric, to follow this into the spiritual world. Death and birth draw together, whereas in the customary consciousness they lie before us as separate facts. But all that is thus brought by means of investigation out of the spiritual world can be completely grasped by the ordinary consciousness in the way that I have explained in the first part of today's lecture. It is only necessary that one should free oneself from what the customary consciousness demands for the present day. I once knew a man, you see, who said, quote, "A stone falls. If I raise a chair and release it, it falls. Everything falls to the earth. People assert that the earth does not rest upon anything at all, but it would necessarily fall," said he. And he did not consider that everything on the earth must fall because the earth is there, that the earth itself moves freely in world space as the stars in their totality mutually support and sustain one another. Those persons who maintain today that everything must be proven through the external senses after the model of contemporary science resemble the man who says, quote, if the earth does not rest upon a great block, it must fall, unquote. Anthroposophical truths are of such a character that they mutually support one another like the stars. Men must come to this. And when one has arrived at this point through ordinary consciousness, one then begins really to grasp anthroposophy by way of ideas, even such things as the drawing together of birth and death. Or let us proceed further. Let us observe clearly how a person who has previously prepared himself well by means of what contemporary science can explain, but who places himself amidst this with a more living receptivity, learns to know now not the entire human being, but the organs, in the way I explained yesterday. Indeed, you see, this knowledge of the organs, this knowledge of the organs gained upon the way of initiation, does not place birth and death before the soul, but something entirely different. Before this knowledge of the organs, birth and death have entirely lost their customary meaning. For only the entire man can really die. A single organ cannot die. The lungs, for example, do not die. Even ordinary science has an inkling of this now, that when the entire man is dead, the individual organs may be vitalized in a certain manner for themselves. The individual organs do not die, no matter whether the man is buried or cremated. The individual organs seek, each according to its nature, a way outward into the cosmos, even though the man lies in the earth, and if he has been buried, the earth covers him completely. The organs seek their way through water, air, and warmth into the cosmos. The organs are really released, but do not die. Only the man as a whole dies. To speak of death in connection with a human being has a meaning only as regards the man as a whole. In the case of the animal, we must say of the organs that they die. In the case of the human being, the contrast to the animal lies in the fact that the organs are released. They simply release themselves quickly, just as when you cook a green apple, it passes in a certain sense more quickly through the same process as the ripe apple. Burial is the gradual process. Cremation is the quick process. The organs can also be followed in their characteristics as they pass outward into infinity. But out there in the cosmos, they do not withdraw to infinity. But what I described yesterday comes back to one, the great human being, the cosmic man. When therefore we observe the organs with the initiate consciousness, we see what really happens to the organs in death, this passing out according to their kinship into the regions of the cosmos. The heart goes to a different place from the lungs. The liver goes to a different place from the lungs and the heart. They are distributed throughout the cosmos. We can perceive this if we have developed, on the way of initiation, the consciousness of the organs, the consciousness in regard to the organs. This man then appears before us. Man then appears as he is really incorporated into the cosmos. And in our vision of this man, as he is really incorporated into the cosmos, that may be represented, which lies at the basis, for example, of successive incarnations. We need this perception, which comes not from the vision of the man as a whole, but only from the vision of the organs, in order to know again the return of previous earth lives to perception in this earth life. It is for this reason, you see, that persons who devote themselves to the spiritual world by the moon way, such as mystics, theosophists, etc., have certainly perceived all possible sorts of things, human souls as they have lived previously, gods, spirits. But they could not really know, could not grasp what these were, could not speak in a definite manner about them. Quote, this is Alanus ab Insulus, this is Dante, this is Brunetto Latini, unquote. The beings were there. They were at times quite grotesquely situated. Previous incarnations were there. But it was not possible to determine whether they were one's own or those of strangers or what others they were. The result was that the spiritual world enters into this night world conjured into the day. But it is then released under the influence of the impulse of Venus. It is now present as a spiritual world in its totality. It does not possess the definiteness it should possess. You see, the possibility thus begins in the present world of seeing how the human being is placed in his totality in the world, how he exists as a cosmic being. On the other hand, there is connected with this, I may say, an extraordinarily tragic knowledge. For if the human being were only man in his totality, as he appears in his skin here on earth, what a good, what a gentle, what a noble being he would be. Just as little as it is possible to investigate death by means of ordinary consciousness, we can grasp death in the sense indicated, but we cannot investigate it. Just so little is it possible also to investigate by means of ordinary consciousness why men with their candid countenances, truly they all have such candid countenances, why with these candid countenances they may also become evil. That is, a person does not become evil as a whole human being. The skin is somewhat extraordinarily honest. A person becomes evil by means of the individual organs. It is in the organs that the possibility of evil lies. One learns, therefore, in connection with the kinship of the organs to individual cosmic regions, to understand from which cosmic region the condition of being obsessed with evil comes. For such is its fundamental character, even in the case of the least evil. Thus, in connection with the human being, there first appears from our knowledge of the whole man birth and death. Secondly, there appears from our knowledge of the organization of man kinship with the cosmos in states of health and disease, and also evil. And thus that figure also which passed through the mystery of Golgotha can appear before the human soul only when we have first the capacity by way of human organology to perceive a cosmic man. For it was as a cosmic man that Christ came from the sun. He had never previously been an earthly man. He came here as a cosmic man. How is it possible to know a cosmic man if we have not previously prepared ourselves to conceive the cosmic man at all? It is from this very grasp of the cosmic man that a Christology may be derived. You see, thus, how the right ways lead into the spiritual world, lead to a knowledge of birth and death, lead to a knowledge of the kinship of human organs with the cosmos, lead to a knowledge of evil, lead to a knowledge of the cosmic man, Christ. All this, if it is set forth in such a way that it is mutually supported, can be understood. And this understanding is then the best way through which we ourselves may enter into it, understanding and meditation concerning that wherein we are in understanding. The other rules for meditation are then still further supports. But such is the right way into the spiritual world for every human being of the present time. On the other hand, all testing of other ways that do not pass through ordinary consciousness and sustain the ordinary consciousness, all testing with consciousness excluded, as in the case of mediumism, somnambulism, hypnosis, etc., all investigations after the manner of a caricature of contemporary science into such a world of processes as we cannot reach by means of the higher consciousness, all this constitutes false ways, for these do not lead into the real spiritual world. When a person becomes aware through his feeling, and he can do this, of what is obtained through research, as I have indicated, that by means of organic knowledge the cosmic human being comes back to us, and the Christ can in a certain sense be understood in this return, when a person feels this, which is accessible to occult research and vision, when this comes about in the feeling nature of a man, then the heavenly is in a certain sense revealed within the earthly, through this feeling and the consciousness that I have indicated to you, and this happens by means of art. In art, a half-conscious element of the soul holds firmly to that which comes to a man out of the spiritual world by the retrospective way, by that retrospective way which I have described. It is for this reason that in all ages those persons who were predestined thereto by their karma have laid hold upon the spiritual through the earthly material in art. Our naturalistic art has departed from this, but every climax in the evolution of art in human history represents a spiritual within the sensible, or we might also say lifts the sensible into the sphere of the spiritual. The reason why we prize the painter Raphael so highly is because he was in a position, as no one else has been in the same degree, to set forth in the sensible something which lifts itself up to the spiritual. Now, there has been in general in the course of human evolution such a time as was primarily inclined to the plastic, the formative art. We must discover again in our day a new life in the formative arts, but the direct elementary impulse in the formative arts flowed into past times. For a long time, for hundreds of years, that other impulse has been developing, the impulse toward the musical. It is for this reason that even the formative arts take on more or less of a musical form. From an artistic point of view, the musical constitutes the future of humanity, and everything musical may come into existence, including also what is otherwise in the arts of speech. The Goetheanum building in Dornach was embraced within the musical. It is for this reason that it has generally been so little understood as architecture and sculpture and painting. Even a person who ought to understand will understand with difficulty, for the reason that it is wholly in accordance with human evolution that the musical must be introduced into the plastic, into sculpture, painting, carving. But the very thing to which I have referred, which constitutes a climax in human evolution, the appearance of the form of Christ, the very living, spiritually living form of Christ, this is something which was, in a certain sense, wonderfully attained through painting, through Renaissance painting, and that which preceded it, but which will need to be found through the musical. You see, the urge was there. The urge was there in Richard Wagner, and this urge at last brought Richard Wagner to his Parsifal. But as regards this conjuring of the Christ impulse into the physical world of the senses, this Parsifal is, so to speak, only suffused with a symbolic significance. Where it needs to be most Christian, it is only a symbolism. The dove appears and the like. The communion is symbolic there. That which constitutes the Christ impulse in the cosmos and in the earthly is not actually reached there in the element of the musical. But the musical element is capable of placing this Christ impulse some day in tones, in shaped tones, in tones filled with soul and spirit before the world. If music becomes inspired by anthroposophical spiritual science, it will find the way to this, for it will solve the problem purely artistically, in art by way of the feelings. How that which lives in the cosmic telluric as the Christ impulse may be symphonically imbued with life in tones. To this end it is necessary only that in a deepening of the musical experience, until in inner feeling this passes into the mystical, we shall be able to deepen the sphere of the major third. If we experience this as something musically completely enclosed within the inner being of man, and then feel the sphere of the major fifth, if we feel the sphere of the fifth as that which possesses an encompassing quality, that which possesses such a quality that when the human being grows into the shaping of the fifth, he arrives at the very border line between the human and the cosmic, where the cosmic intones itself into the human yearns outward into the cosmic, indeed storms the cosmos in outward yearning. It is then possible in this very musical element, by means of the mystery occurring between the sphere of the major and that of the major fifth, to experience something of what wills to pass as the inner human outward into the cosmic. And if we arrive at the point of causing the life in the cosmos to sound forth in the dissonances of the seventh, where the dissonances of the seventh express themselves as that which the human being can experience in inner sensations in the cosmos, when he finds himself on the way into the various spiritual regions, and if we arrive at the point of causing the dissonances of the seventh to hover in such a way that through their hovering they take on something definite, the dissonances of the seventh then attain in their hovering to something that represents itself to musical experience as a musical firmament. And if we then find, as the experience of the minor has already been indicated in intimate qualities in the experience of the major, if we then find in this hovering of the dissonances of the seventh, in this self-forming of the dissonances of the seventh, to a totality that is almost harmonic in its totality, that becomes almost a consonance because it hovers, if we find in this the possibility of passing into an intensive minor out of the dissonances of the seventh, out of the almost harmonic qualities of the hovering of the dissonances of the seventh, if we find our way backward into the sphere of the minor fifth, and from there the mingling of the sphere of the minor fifth with the sphere of the minor third, we have then in this way created the experience of incarnation, and indeed of the incarnation of Christ. For it will be possible for us to find in this sense of being outside ourselves in the sphere of the seventh, only seemingly dissonant in the presence of cosmic sensations, a sphere that one forms into a firmament, while we have the octave as if standing behind, but only approximately standing behind, if we have laid hold of this in the feeling, and if we then turn back in the manner indicated and find, as in the germinal form of the consonances of the minor third, the possibility of setting forth the incarnation there as something musical. We may then, if we again pass back to the major in this sphere, then may the hallelujah of Christ sound forth out of this shaping, out of this musical shaping, in a purely musical way, purely out of the shaping of the tones. A human being may then, within the shaping of the tones, conjure into this forming of the tones a directly supersensible. May set it forth for musical sensations. Let me read that sentence again. A human being may then, within the shaping of the tones, conjure into this forming of the tones a directly supersensible, may set it forth for musical sensations. The Christ impulse may be found in the musical, and that resolution of the symphonic into what is no longer entirely musical, which existed with Beethoven, can be carried back again into the really cosmic dominance in the musical element. Because of a certain narrowness, and I might say because of a certain traditional limitation, Bruckner sought for this. But the way in which he came to a standstill within this is evident in the symphonies he left, as we have them on the one hand in their wonderful character, but on the other hand in a certain groping before oneself by means of the really musical element, and a failure to arrive at a full experience of this musical element, which can be experienced only in the manner that I have indicated, when we advance in the purely musical and find within the musical that which is essential, that which possesses being, which is capable of conjuring a world into tones. It will most certainly be possible some day, if humanity does not fall into decadence, to bring into existence through anthroposophical inspiration what I have indicated. And so it may some day happen. It depends entirely upon men. It may some day happen that just here in the musical, the Christ impulse in its true form shall appear also in external revelation. I wished to place this before your souls because of the reason that you can thus see that anthroposophy will flow into life in all the different spheres. And this can happen if life also really on the other side finds the way, the right way to anthroposophy, to anthroposophical research. Indeed, it may happen that what exists here in the anthroposophical sphere may sometimes sound forth like an echo out of the musical, as if the echo were the resolution of the Christological riddle. With these words I have wished to round out what I could only suggest to you, indeed by means of these lectures could only suggest what purposes are bound up with them. I should like to add still only this word, the wish that I may have succeeded in stimulating a little within your souls that to which I have sought to call your attention by means of these presentations of anthroposophical truths, that these anthroposophical truths can in fact become germs in every soul, which may arise into life, which may lead to an ever broader and broader life in civilization. May this cycle of lectures also be a small contribution toward these far-reaching purposes of the anthroposophical will. The end of Lecture 11 and the end of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Initiate Consciousness, Truth and Error in Spiritual Research. This book is also known as the book True and False Paths in Spiritual Investigation. Please see about this book on the website under the picture of this book.